This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll talk with Stanley Nelson, the reporter for the Concordia Sentinel. He's been hot on the trail of trying to solve cold cases involving murder cases in Mississippi in the 1960s. We'll talk with him about the latest development regarding the brutal death of Frank Morris in 1964 and how the man who did it may have gotten away with murder. Also on the show, we'll talk with Robert Travis Scott, the president of the Public Affairs Research Council. He says he's neutral on Medicaid expansion. We'll find out why, even though his top health advisor, David Hood, has been out there saying the governor is dead wrong in not expanding Medicaid as spelled out under Obamacare. And we'll visit with Melanie Gideon. She is the program manager for Operation Mend, a fascinating program at the UCLA Medical Center for Wounded Veterans. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is Stanley Nelson. He has been reporting from Concordia Parish for the Concordia Sentinel for some time regarding cold cases and racially charged murder cases in the 1960s in Mississippi near the Louisiana border. And we have talked with Stanley several times over the last few years regarding his project, which has gained nationwide acclaim, justified. In fact, the New York Times has picked up on this story in the last month or so. And there has been a development in the infamous case of Frank Morris, a business person in the Natchez Vidalia area who was killed in 1964 in Faraday. And Stanley Nelson, good morning to you.
Hey, Jim. Good morning.
Well, we've talked about Frank Morris, who died December 14th, 1964, in Faraday during the early morning hours of December 10th. His business was torched by some white supremacists, and you think you have unearthed the person responsible for this, and what has happened since we last visited?
Well, what happened, Jim, is about three years ago, we talked to some members of the family from a man named Ravel, from Ravel, Louisiana. His name was Leonard Spencer. And these family members, a son, an ex-wife, the ex-brother-in-law, said that years ago, this man told them, two Klansmen actually, were implicated in this arson of Frank Morris's shoe shop, and that this man, Mr. Spencer and Ravel, had told them that he was involved in that arson. We talked with Mr. Spencer in the summer of 2010. He denied having anything to do with the arson. The other Klansman that was implicated, he denied knowing him. And he talked at great length about the Klan. He actually provided a pretty good history of the Ravel Klan, but was steadfast that it was absolutely false. He had nothing to do with that arson. The FBI had been made aware of these allegations in the summer of 2009. And the fall of 2010, we called the FBI and Justice Department and let them know that we had talked to these folks and that we would like to do a story. We were doing a story, and could they comment? They asked us, would we give them a couple of months, that they had some more investigative work to do before we ran the story, which we did that. Ran the story in January. Next month, the grand jury in Concordia was convened. And a couple of weeks ago, Mr. Spencer died. And a few days after that, the FBI indicated that they had no evidence that could link him to the Morris arson. So we're kind of back to square one. Was Mr. Spencer involved? He says he was not. The family member says that he admitted to it. And, we don't know and may not know all of the facts there. We don't know why the FBI said that they basically had cleared him, and we don't know why they said it after he died.
Well, why did the FBI take this move after, according to some reports, not really putting in a strong effort to investigate the claims that you and the Concordia Sentinel were making?
Well, I think that's an interesting and a good question. When you're looking at cases that are 50 years old, you certainly have to move on any type of information that you have, I would think. We were curious to know why they had heard about this person 17 months prior to when we had called. You know, why had there not been any activity on that? And the problem is we don't really know whether there was or wasn't, and may not know until after this case is officially closed, because when a case is an open investigation, the Bureau and Justice Department will not comment. But I think it points to the fact with Mr. Clint, Mr. Spencer, who was, you know, denied this, and the FBI did clear him. The question or the issue that is very, really clear is time. And he's dead. Other suspects that were still alive when the FBI reopened some of these cold cases in 2007. Many suspects, many witnesses have died. A suspect in the Frank Morris case from the 1960s died since this case was reopened. A suspect in another case we're covering, Joseph Edwards, a Vidalia Motel porter who went missing in 1964. The prime suspect in that case, died in 2009, 2 years after the case was reopened. Two key witnesses in that case, maybe the two witnesses that put into motion Joseph Edwards' disappearance, died since this case has been reopened. To our knowledge, the FBI has not talked to many of these people. So, you know, time passes, and every day that passes, people are dying, and resolution of these cases get more and more difficult. And it's a shame, because these were not just isolated incidences. There were many, many, or many cold cases, just like Frank Morris and Joseph Edwards, Wallace Jackson and Natchez, that remained unsolved. And this was sort of, this is our last chance. We'll never get an opportunity again to solve these cases, and there were 100-plus cases reopened in 2007. Mm-hmm. Now we're down to 20. I think it's likely we'll see the number reduced again this year, maybe by half, maybe more. And so, you know, you would have to say that this initiative to solve these old cases has been a failure.
Well, in January 11th of 2011, the Concordia Sentinel reported that the son of Arthur Leonard Spencer, his ex-wife and ex-brother-in-law, implicated him in the arson that took the life of Frank Morris. And two of the three, Spencer's son and ex-brother-in-law, said Spencer told them he was involved. The ex-wife said another Klansman implicated himself and Spencer in the murder of Morris. Now, this is over 2 years ago. The Justice Department has had ample opportunity to follow up before the death of Mr. Spencer. And considering that during that time, the Justice Department, as we know, was spying on reporters for the Associated Press, spying on a reporter for Fox News, perhaps those efforts could have been better suited to take place in the town of Faraday, Louisiana. It seems to me that there may be a priority issue regarding the Justice Department right now.
Well, I think that's certainly a fair comment, and first of all, I'm a reporter, and I am not an FBI agent or a Justice Department lawyer, and I certainly have great respect for those folks, and I have great respect for the agents that they've had working in the field on these cases. My questions have been, are you putting enough man hours on these cases? Because agents that are assigned to work these cases aren't working them full-time, and I can tell you FBI agents out in the field have a tremendous workload. I don't think the public really understands just how hard and how many cases these people have to work. It's overwhelming. So my thought was, why not assign a handful of agents to do nothing but work these cases? In the Frank Morris case, we're now on our fourth case agent. And what a case agent is, they're the person in charge, basically, of out in the field, working this case through. And these are complicated cases. They are historic cases. They took place 50 years ago. You have to have an understanding of what the conditions were like, who the people were, who the Klansmen were, who law enforcement, who those people were. And it is impossible for an agent to come in and work on a case for a year and a half and then have someone else come in and follow behind them. And the FBI will say that we handle cold cases like this and under the same type of structure, and we can do it. I just question that. That's my opinion. I don't think you can work a 50-year-old case. I think people need to stay on these cases until the end. And the other question that, one of the other questions that I have is, we were in Concordia Parish in the 1960s. We had an agent come in here by the name of John Pfeiffer. Pfeiffer spent probably 13 years in Concordia Parish, and as a result of his investigations, a chief deputy here who was a suspect in both the Frank Morris and Joseph Edwards murders, name of Frank DeLauder, and eventually the sheriff of Concordia Parish, Noel Cross, were each convicted in a case involving the Moorville Lounge, which was a mob-based prostitution and gambling den in Concordia Parish. Also, DeLauder was convicted along with two other men in a police brutality case where a prisoner was beaten almost to death in the Faraday Jail in 1965. Pfeiffer covered these cases, followed these two cases in particular, until the early 1970s when convictions were obtained in both the Moorville Lounge case and in the police brutality case, and both the sheriff was removed from office, served time in jail, and Frank DeLauder was as well. Pfeiffer's years here, these two cases were part of a larger civil rights era case known as the Wallace Jackson case, called War Bomb. And Jackson was a NAACP treasurer in Natchez who was killed in a car bomb in Natchez in 1967. When they came in to investigate that case 3 years after the Morris arson, the FBI decided, we have so much violence going on in this region that we have to look not only at this case, but we have to look at all of these peripheral cases where there's been arsons and there's been murders and there's been beatings, because we have to rub out this violence, and our big problem seems to be Concordia Parish. Well, of all of the cases that they picked up, they eventually reopened the Frank Morris case. They reopened the Joseph Edwards, they opened for the first time the Joseph Edwards case in 1967. And as a result of all of these different cases, there were only two successful prosecutions, and those two were the Moorville Lounge and the police brutality case. John Pfeiffer, who was on the ground here, as I said, for more than a decade, he died last year. And the FBI, today's FBI, never went and sat down and talked to that man, never asked his advice, never asked, what should we do? Where did you leave off? What do you think? Mm-hmm. And there's other agents who worked in this area during that period. They've never been talked to.
Well, in the Morris case, which you, of course, have covered earnestly, William Boo Spencer said his father said that Morris's shop was targeted because Morris was a black man who owned his own business. Now, if this doesn't smack of a hate crime, of a terrible murder that what is now 49 years old almost, something the government should look into, what does constitute something the government should concentrate upon? Do you think the U.S. government has let the people of Concordia Parish and, by extension, the people of the United States down?
Well, I think we all have. I mean, we have to keep in mind, yes, I do. I do think that the U.S. government has let Concordia Parish down and the areas where these other cases occur, they've let them down. But also, I always want to point out to the fact that for the past 50 years, wherever there's a cold case, and we've looked at several, wherever there's a cold case, there has been an elected sheriff, there's been an elected DA, who all of this time, these cases occurred in their home territories. These are cold cases that happened in their jurisdiction. At any time, these folks could have also picked up and taken a look at these cases. So we all bear responsibility.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Stanley Nelson. Appreciate your remarks, and we'll be calling again. This is something that warrants attention, and you've got quite a story to tell, and there's still more, I'm sure, revelations to come. Thank you, Stanley.
Thank you.
Take care, and we'll be back with Robert Travis Scott after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org works if you're inclined to reach us online. In studio is Robert Travis Scott, the president of the Public Affairs Research Council. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Jim.
Been down at the Capitol the last few months. How are things at the Capitol these days?
Well, you know, these days we're all counting the hours until 6 o'clock on June the 6th when the whole thing has to wrap up. Of course, there's a lot of talk about maybe a special session, but that's usually just a lot of part of the whole bluffing and negotiation mm-hmm. as you go into the home stretch.
Well, the governor started the Capitol by saying that, started the session by saying that he would not accept the Medicaid money under Obamacare. He's held true to his word, and lawmakers are falling in line, lockstep. Any surprise that they followed his course of action on this?
Well, I don't know if you'd call it lockstep. I think there have been a lot of
Well, there have been 37 House members, right. But 59 said no. That's a pretty big
gap. No, I agree. They're going along with him. I was just quibbling with your words. But, no, I think it's the Medicaid expansion is a real tough one because you're kind of damned if you do it and damned if you don't do it. And you have a situation where it could be very expensive in the long run. If you take it on, you may be pulling a lot of people off of private insurance who are mm-hmm. currently insured and putting them on public insurance, Medicaid. At the same time, you have the advantages of trying to get some people who are uninsured into some type of insurance program, in this case Medicaid, which may or may not be the best. But you may be able to manage their health care better in the long run, and you just may overall have a better system. So it's really tough. And if you don't accept it also, there's a certain classes of people who will not be available for the exchanges when they come up and will get subsidized care, and there'll be others who will be left out of that equation. So, like I said, there's pluses and minuses in going along with it. PAR hasn't taken a position on it. What we did do...
Well, hold that thought.
Hold that thought.
All right. March 29th, headline in The Advocate. PAR turns up heat over Medicaid expansion. That's mm-hmm. that big headline.
That's what I was about to
and
talk about.
And it says,
yeah.
PAR again called for Jindal to lay out his alternative path for health care coverage for Louisiana's uninsured if he continues to reject the Medicaid expansion.
That's right.
Has he done that?
Yeah, I think we played a really important role in this and in saying, look, we are going into this debate in the session. We don't really have the right information and the right analysis to evaluate what the real numbers are and what the real risks are, what the financial costs and advantages are. And we want the Department of Health and Hospitals to do a more thorough study. And they did that. We really, within a very short time after we came out with our report, they responded, and they responded in kind and in detail. And actually, their report was pretty good. And they gave a range of costs of the program and identified the pluses and the minuses. And I think it helped contribute to a better and more accurate evidence-based debate.
So you think the governor's done the right thing?
So we did the right thing.
Has the governor done the right thing?
PAR hasn't taken a position on it. And here's the reason, Jim. I think there are so many people involved in this who have an agenda. And our agenda really is the facts. And somebody needs to play that role in just making sure that people are being honest on both sides and that we're getting the right facts out there. And I think that's the service we've done.
Well, David Hood, who works for PAR, was on this show, and he's taken a position on it, took out an ad in the newspaper saying the governor is doing the wrong thing.
Well, yeah, David is a former DHH secretary. He worked as a senior analyst for PAR for a number of years. He no longer holds that position. We have Don Gregory, who's a former head of the state mm-hmm. Medicaid office, who's doing research for us and some writing on these issues. He's a great analyst, and he's our front runner guy right now.
So Parr has not taken a position, but it sounds like you may be leaning toward the governor's path on this, Robert. Nothing wrong with that. Do you think he's doing the right thing?
Well, you know, I understand the cautions, and like I said, we've outlined what we think the concerns are with going with the expansion, but at the same time, we want to make sure we point out what some of the disadvantages are going to be if you don't do it.
Okay. 297-5633, Robert Travis Scott, who, of course, for many years was the Capitol Bureau Chief for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Here's Karen Carter-Peterson, the chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party and a senator from the great city of New Orleans, commenting on the Medicaid morass.
It isn't about the administration and members. It shouldn't be about this administration at the state level, nor should it be about the federal administration when it comes to Obama cares. But in fact, it is. And why is that? Why is that? I have talked to so many members, both in the House and the Senate, and you know what? You ready? You ready what it comes down to? It's not about how many federal dollars we can receive. It's not about that. You ready? It's about race. No, nobody wants to talk about that. It's about the race of this African-American president, because this same thing has been offered by who? Former Speaker Newt Gingrich in the past. Yeah, he had a similar bill to what Obama, President Obama, has offered. Similar legislation was offered. It comes down to the race of the President of the United States, which causes people to disconnect and step away from the substance of the bill. So I agree with Senator Buffington. It shouldn't be about the title. It should not be about the title.
All right. That's Karen Carter-Peterson fired up. Does she have a point? Is it about race?
This is exactly makes the point I was making before of why we need Parr involved in this and just trying to focus on the facts of the real advantages and disadvantages. It's a perfect example of how the rhetoric in this thing can get very overheated. People are bringing a lot of biases into their judgment call on this. I think we all know that there are people who, no matter what Obama does, they'll be against it, and others, no matter what Obama does, they'll be for it. And the same with Jindal. Coming on both sides. Hey, you know, you look back in Governor Jindal back in 2008 proposed a plan that was very much like what we see the Medicaid expansion being right now. He proposed a demonstration project under the Health First plan in which we would have provided 200%, up to 200% of the federal poverty level. Anybody who qualified under that level would get Medicaid coverage in the Lake Charles area. If you went above that amount, you would enter into something very similar to what we see now as an insurance exchange. So just the general idea of trying to expand Medicaid in this manner has been something that even Jindal has considered very seriously in the past. That program was never implemented because it was never really worked out with the federal government to proceed on that, and they went forward with a different plan. But I think it just goes to show that there's a range of views on this, and sometimes I think they're politically tinged. All the more important for us to just try to be as factual as we can.
But the governor is the governor, and lawmakers, he has the majority in both houses. They are marching in lockstep with the governor. At least all the Republicans are, and some Democrats, I might add, are as well. So some would say it's a bit surprising that only 37 House members voted against a man whose popularity level is at 37-38%, according to recent polls. They apparently aren't putting much stock in these polls, or if they are, they say the power of the governor's office supersedes any poll numbers that show the governor is declining.
Well, I think the point you're trying to make is that all these votes should be directed by how popular the governor is or what they think of the governor. I mean, it's entirely possible, Jim. A lot of those people made those votes based on their own evaluation of the Medicaid program.
Well, and there are very few white lawmakers who voted with Karen Carter Peterson and others. Now, this was a House vote, obviously. Karen Carter's in the Senate, but when you look at the list, the black caucus and a few whites, and that's it. John Bel Edwards, by the way, who will be running for governor in a few years, was one of those who was among the 37 to say we needed to take the Medicaid money, we, the state of Louisiana. But they were outnumbered by a significant margin, and the governor is showing his clout. He's still got, I think one thing we can agree on, he's got power, he's using it, and lawmakers are respecting that power.
Well, you know, the budget process has been interesting. I think they've shown a healthy amount of independence, both in the House and as this budget bill goes through. They've shown a little distance from the governor on a lot of issues. I think that's been a good trend. They've opposed the governor on a pretty significant piece of legislation that would place into the Constitution a new program that would have assessments for hospitals in which they would, in return, receive higher provider rates. They'd get better compensation for it. It's a system that's used in a lot of states, and Governor Jindal's administration has criticized this particular effort, but there's been overwhelming support in the legislature for it. So I think it depends on the issue a great deal, Jim. I don't think you could look down the line at all the significant bills that are out there and say that in every single case the legislature has gone along with the governor, and particularly not in lockstep.
When have they rejected an initiative from the governor?
Well, you may recall, Jim, that the whole session began. It got off to a flying stop. Probably one of the most significant
on the tax swap.
That's right. Probably one of the most significant proposals that Governor Jindal has made since he's been in office was a very strong effort to restructure our state tax system, in particular repealing the personal income tax. That fell so flat that even on the first day of the session, he conceded, and what he said, he parked the bills, and didn't move forward with it. And he had nothing else to say in terms of his agenda for the session. So it was a really awkward beginning to the session, and it was a major rejection by the legislature of a major General Jindal program, even before the session got underway. And they tried to revamp things, and a week later it was finally flushed all the way down.
Well, in that case, there was massive public opposition to it. And I have a feeling that if there was massive public opposition to the governor's stand on Medicaid expansion, the lawmakers might be acting differently than they are. I don't feel that there is that kind of opposition as there was to raising sales taxes.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I think that lawmakers do listen to the phone calls and letters, and they have their ears out in their districts trying to get a sense of what people in their area are in favor of or against. And I think they are motivated to some extent by what their constituents think or what they perceive their constituents to think.
Story today from Marcia Shuler of The Advocate, saying lawmakers yesterday approved two resolutions putting Planned Parenthood operations in Louisiana under scrutiny by state and local officials. Julie Mickleberry of Planned Parenthood Gulf Coast was not pleased with this, saying this is really about opponents of women's health singling out a health care provider who thousands of working people trust and using the legislature to advance inappropriate legislation for their own political agenda. House Resolution 105, passing on a 90-4 vote, that's 90-4, urged the State Department of Health and Hospitals to immediately suspend all grants and reimbursements, about $1 million annually, pursuant to its Medicaid provider agreement with Planned Parenthood Gulf Coast. And a similarly worded resolution, Senate Concurrent Resolution 57, asked DHH, the Division of Administration, the Legislative Auditor, and the Office of the Inspector General to review and monitor the practices of Planned Parenthood Gulf Coast to determine whether the organization is in compliance with state and federal laws. So, is this intimidation of Planned Parenthood?
Well, I'm watching it with interest just like everyone else. This is not an area that PAR really gets into, I'm no more familiar with it than the next person.
But it is a budget measure.
Well, it's interesting, yeah. And obviously, there's always a political overtone to these issues. And so I'll be interested to see, you know, how this eventually comes out.
But Planned Parenthood, on a vote involving $1 million in funding, could only get 4 votes in the House. Planned Parenthood's not the most popular organization in the House of Representatives. About as popular as those who believe in the theory of evolution. That only got 3 votes in the House a few years ago.
Three votes.
Three votes. How about that? 3 votes. So Louisiana, are we a progressive state, Robert Travis Scott?
You know, I, that is a concern that I have, is how progressive we're seen from the outside, you know, with a lot of these policies. Now, are we doing it because we really believe in these principles, or are we doing it because we think politically it sells well back home? When you come across looking like you're rejecting evolution and not looking at a really not willing to be open minded about it, I think it probably does hurt us.
297-5633. We'll spend a bit more time with Robert Travis Scott, the president of the Public Affairs Research Council, and in a few weeks, Robert will sit in as guest host for a few days. That's a welcome occurrence.
Where are you going, Jim?
I haven't decided yet, Robert, but I understand one of your guests will be John Georges.
Yeah, he's the new publisher of The Advocate, and it looks like we may have him lined up to come on to the show so we can talk about the future of The Advocate and its impact on the community. I think that'll be a great conversation.
And of course,
now I won't have Jim Inkster's Googlepedic knowledge of sports and trivia and music and politics in Louisiana.
Well,
I'll have to rely on the real Google for
that. You can ask John Georges, as we have once before on this show a few years back, about him saving the life of one Peter Frampton. Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on with Robert Travis Scott.
Good morning, gentlemen. Two quick questions. The House resolution, I wonder why they didn't pass one to see why Earl K. Long was not relocated to Women's Hospital instead of given to the Lady of the Lake. And the other question is...
All right, one question per customer.
Oh, so. Wow. Look at him on.
What about Earl K. Long? That's a Baton Rouge issue.
Well, yeah, and this is a program that has been underway for years, and I think it shows that the privatization of some of these public hospitals that these institutions at the state have had, it takes time to make these changes, and it takes a lot of direction, and you have to be willing to make adjustments as you go along. Overall, I think it was probably a good move. And I think overall, Parr over the years has wanted to see the charity hospitals, these institutions, we've wanted to see a more private approach to these so that the state is not in the business, and in particular the way it's run now, the LSU system is not in the business of running a bunch of hospitals, but is in fact focused on the mission of doing education and medical education in the hospitals. So overall, this is a very historic time for Louisiana to shift from the old charity hospital system to a different one. Now, there's still a lot of questions about this. We have gone through a lot of privatizations of hospitals, state hospitals across the state. There's still a lot that we have to see as to whether or not these are going to turn out well. We're going to have to see if the federal government, the CMS department in particular, will approve of these particular lease deals and arrangements that have been set up. We want to see if there truly will be cost savings in where we've gone. A lot of these deals seem to be driven more by short-term financial concerns than the long-term health concerns and care management concerns.
All right.
Now, we may find out they were great.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757. We'll spend a bit more time with Robert Travis Scott, president of PAR, former Capital Bureau chief for the Times-Picayune. And we'll hear from Julie Gideon. She is the program manager for Operation Mend, a major endeavor at UCLA regarding helping wounded veterans. Back after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher producing. 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Those are your numbers. In just a moment, we'll hear from Melanie Gideon, the program manager of a worthy endeavor at UCLA, fascinating operation called Operation Mend. But we are wrapping it up with Robert Travis Scott, president of PAR. How many years now?
Almost 2.5 years.
So this is your third regular session. Is that right?
At par, but of course I covered it for years as right. Capitol bureau chief for the Times-Picayune.
Wearing a different hat. How is it
but
on the other
side? I was wearing the same seersucker suit.
How is it on the other side?
Well, you know, I'm still dealing with a lot of the same issues and a lot of the same people. It's just more focused on particular issues, you know.
All right.
But, you know, Jim, just to finish up on that last thought about the hospitals, you know, like I said, I think overall, you know, we like seeing the general direction we're going with the privatization of the hospital, public hospital systems. But as we get into this, you know, we're going to have to keep making adjustments as far from over, you know, how many beds are there in these particular communities? Do we have overcapacity? What's going to be the long-term funding mechanism for these? What is the impact of the changes mm-hmm. in Medicaid and lower amounts of disproportionate share hospital payments to make up for people who are being cared for without coverage? All these things are going to continue to be issues that we're going to have to look at to see if we can make these public-private hospital deals work in the long run. We're going to continue to have to work on these and refine them, I'm sure, over the years.
All right. Kenny wants to know if you will fire David Hood for going off the ranch and speaking in favor of Medicaid expansion. You say Parr is not taking a stand. He's a man who works for you who did take a stand.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad David is out there expressing himself the way he wants to, and I think it's great. I think he's a really smart guy with a lot of experience, and I'm glad to see him out there contributing to the debate. But no, it had nothing to do.
But,
had nothing to do. His views had nothing to do with our relationship.
But
with Parr.
He's working for Parr.
He does some consulting for Parr still. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he is in favor of Medicaid expansion, and you're saying Parr is not.
That's right. Mm-hmm. We're saying that we're just
something doesn't add up.
You know, Joe, I don't think so at all. No, I mean, we take a lot of views from a lot of people, and we're glad to have his thoughts on things. I think he makes a valuable contribution to our thought process. I think it's great.
Did you give him a talking to off mic?
Yeah, I did. I told him he should go out and express himself, as best he can on the issues he feels strongly about.
Well, he said that when Governor Jindal was Secretary of the Department of Health, and remember, David Hood succeeded the governor and worked with the governor, he said the Bobby Jindal of 1996 was a much more pragmatic man than the one of 2013.
David knew Bobby Jindal in 96, and I didn't. But
you went back to the governor's birthplace, not his birthplace, but his parents'
yeah,
birthplace.
Yeah, he was born in Baton Rouge.
He was born in Baton Rouge, right. But he was conceived in India, and you went back home, and it was an interesting several-part series. That was quite a fascinating journey.
It was
you.
Absolutely fascinating, and just the whole story of his family, his mother and father, and how they met. They were from different economic classes, and just the story of them coming over here, and it was just a very interesting, great story, kind of a classic American success story. And of course, that was back at a time when they came over, when there really wasn't a big Indian community here in Baton Rouge. There wasn't a lot of a young Bobby Jindal growing up. You know, he didn't have a lot of connections with his home country, and they didn't go back that often. So I think he really evolved as someone who wanted to become a more typical Baton Rouge kid, mm-hmm. and that's how it went along. And so I don't think his roots in Indian culture and his roots in Indian heritage, I don't think are that strong.
Well, his Damien notes that his wife, our First Lady, Supriya, was born in India, and is the first foreign-born First Lady of Louisiana, and stands to be the first foreign-born First Lady of the United States.
How about that? Very interesting. That sounds like
Did you know she was born in India?
Yeah, you know, I don't. I do remember reporting it, but I don't remember where she was born. No.
She was born in Delhi.
Is that right? Okay.
Not to be confused with Delhi.
That's right. She could just put Delhi on there, and then she could call herself a Louisianian for sure.
All right. Well, Robert Travis Scott, good to visit with you.
And always good to be on the show, Jim. Thanks a lot.
Be asking questions of John George's on the 11th, I believe. So mark that on your calendar.
Okay, great.
Ray Nagin's birthday, and John George's will be here answering questions from Robert Travis Scott. We're visiting now with Melanie Gideon, joining us from Los Angeles, the Operation MEND program manager at UCLA. Good morning, Melanie. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having us on the show.
Well, I'm glad you're starting your morning with us. Operation Mend is a groundbreaking program providing returning military personnel with severe facial and other medical injuries access to the nation's top plastic and reconstructive surgeries. This is something that is done through a partnership envisioned by the Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center Board and the executive committee that is now involved with this program. It is something that is certainly a worthy endeavor, and you have a number of people involved, don't you, as far as patients and personnel?
Yes, we absolutely do. Operation Mend started back in 2007 when we recognized that there was a kind of a gap a little bit in some of the service that was provided, particularly with facial injuries. Some of the IEDs were creating extreme disfigurement to a lot of service members, and they didn't necessarily have plastic surgeons equipped at all of the military treatment facilities to kind of get these service members able to close their mouths again and close their eyes again and chew food and things like that. So we started the program with facial reconstruction, and over the last 6 years have expanded to pretty much anything you can think of. So any specialty injury we take care of.
Well, the Bob Woodruff, the reporter for ABC, who was hit by a bomb in Iraq, he's an example of somebody who had facial reconstruction, and if you looked at him, you wouldn't know that he was ever hurt. But it's remarkable what can be done now, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we have, you know, Bob's a good example, but he, I would say his injuries weren't quite as extreme as some of the injuries that UCLA sees. So we have, it's really the burn injuries, so severe burn, facial injuries, hand injuries. That's how the program started. And then, yeah, as I mentioned, it's gone on to different orthopedic injuries, spinal injuries, hand injuries. We're dealing with mild traumatic brain injury diagnosis, pretty much all across the spectrum of health right now.
Right now, how many total patients do you have, Melanie?
So we have approximately 85 patients that have come through, and that may not sound like a big number, obviously, but if a patient, you know, our first patient has had over 29 procedures over the last 6 years. So a lot of these patients require multiple surgeries over the course of years. And, you know, the good thing is that we fly them in with their entire family, whoever makes them feel, you know, comfortable in Los Angeles. And so it's multiple visits over the course of years, really.
I see 53 from the Army, 26 from the Marines, 3 from the Navy, 3 Air Force, 1 Army National Guard. What can be done today is remarkable compared to just a few years ago. The technology is quite compelling, isn't it?
Oh, it's incredible. They say, you know, the only victor in war is medicine. The things that have come out of these wars, the medicine, the technology is just, I mean, a perfect example was the, you know, unfortunately, the Boston bombings. The treatment that went into treating those patients was a lot of those techniques were developed because of war injuries. So it's really, really remarkable.
How did you get involved with Operation Mend?
So I just was really lucky, and there was a lot of hard work involved. But I was the first administrative intern for the chief operating officer at UCLA as I was getting my master's at the University of Michigan. So luckily, they brought me back out, and the program had only been going for about a year, and there were 4 patients in the program. So I said, "Here you go. Here's a piece of paper called Operation Mend. It has some phone numbers on it." And we built, you know, over the course of the last few years, we've built this big program and have been able to help a lot of families and a lot of service members try to, you know, become whole again. Our program, I would say, is very different from a lot of other military programs because I'm sure, as you know, there are thousands and thousands of programs that have been developed in this era of war. But our program not only focuses on the injured service member, but we really, really wrap our arms around the entire family. So we offer a lot of psychological services and family care management for the families that come in with these service members because the stress that they've been dealing with over these years is just, some of them present higher PTSD than even the patients. So we really are trying to develop the program around the family to get them back on their feet together.
Operation Mend is funded through an existing grant with the Iraq-Afghanistan Deployment Impact Fund via the California Community Foundation, along with important individual donor support. Now, these injuries that we're talking about, the facial injuries, they're extreme, as you talk about burns. It is often amazing now what people can survive as far as trauma to the body. There has to be a psychological component to this for the victims and their families. How does that work?
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, in terms of our funding, we are donor funded. So everything, you know, the donor funding has created, has built our program up and allowed us to sustain and move forward. But it's always something that we're seeking, I guess. We do know that we never want to say no to an eligible patient. Our goal is to always be able to say yes. We have no waiting list. And that's really always been our goal. So in terms of the psychological injuries, those can be just as dramatic as the facial disfigurement of the bomb going off. You know, I mean, they have seen things that we've never could ever imagine. And the concussions that occur in these injuries can really, be disabling in many ways. Getting back in with, you know, with their families, going back to work, the anxiety and the headaches, you know, and the short-term memory loss and all of those things, they're all playing a part in this patient's life. So we try to look at the whole picture. You know, it's really important that we don't just focus on the injury and try to, you know, put a Band-Aid on it. It's how can we get them back on their feet where they were, you know, the best we can, so...
A listener wants to know about prosthetic devices. You have all kinds of prosthetic opportunities now, even prosthetic ears. How do you go about this?
So we do, you know, these service members are flying in from all different parts of the country. So generally they are already engaged with a military treatment facility or a VA. So a lot of their prosthetics, if it's a limb prosthetic, it usually comes with them, and they are generally pretty happy with their prosthetics. We've had a few instances where we've had to send them off to other places, but prosthetic ears is one of our specialties. We have we call them artists. I mean, if you go over there, they craft ears for about 6 hours after they get the molds and everything made, and they will match it so closely to the skin tone and put hair follicles on there and everything that you wouldn't know that they're fake. So we do provide that. We provide a lot of, you know, oral prosthodontics, things like that.
How has this affected you, seeing these warriors coming home, obviously in dire straits, but fighting their hardest to stay alive and to be vital?
I'll tell you, Jim, I think I'm probably the luckiest person in America right now because, you know, I came from the Midwest, from Michigan, and coming out here, you know, friends joke with me, how's Hollywood, you know, and all I think is, this isn't what I see every day, you know, and these patients and their families really give you an appreciation you could never imagine for what you have and for what you could lose. And I mean, it's really hard sometimes, you know. The first patients that I met were some of the most disfigured, that you couldn't see their eyes, their skin was so disfigured. I mean, no, their noses were missing, their ears were missing, their mouths were completely drooped down to their chin. And that was an eye-opener for me, but it taught me really quickly that, you know, if we can't wrap our arms around these men and women, who's going to do it? You know, we gotta get in there and help in any way. So it's been quite a journey with this program, but it's the best journey I've ever been on.
Well, you probably arrive at work in the shadows of Beverly Hills, seeing remarkable opulence as you're driving in each morning or riding in, however you get there. And then you have to deal with the ultimate reality. It has to be quite an experience on a daily and hourly basis for you.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, today we have a couple patients here. One's in surgery as we speak, and he had some extreme injuries. His eye, he couldn't even close his eyes. So if you can imagine what it would be like to be walking down the street and have a dust, you know, some dust blowing towards you and you can't close your eyes to blink that out. You know, these men and women have, these injuries are just, some of them are horrific. And to be faced with that reality every day, it, like I said, it just makes me feel like I'm doing something that is making an impact. You know, if it's one patient at a time, it's still one person is getting better every day, you know. And our program, if anything, we bring hope to these service members and their families that things are going to get better. You know, no patients walk in our door and go backwards. So that's probably something that we can all say that we're proud of, is that if anything, we provide them hope every single time they come. And that's just really been a driving force for us.
What do you think the future is for Operation Mend?
Well, the future is bright. You know, I mean, there, you've heard the statistics. There are thousands of service members out there who are still injured, who are back at home recovering from their injuries after they retired out of the military. And our goal is to find them. You know, we have our eligibility criteria is really just that they've been injured in this current era of service and they were active duty at the time, and that they have a specialty injury and are stable and able to travel and have a family member that will travel with them.
Well, Melanie, we got a roll, but congratulations on your fine work with Operation Mend. We'll be back tomorrow. For Kevin, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.